Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Featured Voices podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and it is March 26, 2019. As you know, it is my view that the financial markets have become so deformed from increasingly obvious interventions by the central banks that these markets now deserve not one, but two sets of quote marks around them. So, markets. Some of these interventions are quite obvious and everybody agrees on them because they have no choice, right? The central banks, they dropped interest rates to below market clearing levels. That spiked the prices of stocks, bonds, and of course, real estate. Trotting out central bankers on a now almost daily basis to talk the markets higher is such a common event that I've given up even pointing out when it happens, let alone commenting on their words. Further, as a seasoned watcher of the daily or intraday tape, I'm convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that somebody, call it the PPT, the central banks directly, their proxy agents at Citadel, or some combination, right, is routinely intervening in these markets via volatility suppression during via something called the VIX or VIX, as well as futures. Now, why would they do this? Well, because it's a means of having the market send out the right signals so that ordinary folks won't get spooked and carry on borrowing and spending maybe more than they can or should, right? So to share his insights into these markets today, and hopefully to tell me that they are actually free and fair and that I'm needlessly jaded, is Sven Henrik, who I am delighted to finally have on the program. Sven's insights can be found at northmantrader.com and on Twitter using the handle @northmantrader. Sven Henrik is founder and the lead market strategist for Northman Trader. He's been a frequent contributor to CNBC, the Wall Street Journal's Market Watch, as well as known for his diligent technical, directional, and macro analysis of global equity markets, sometimes sarcastically delivered, but always really accurate and timely. He publishes the Daily Market Brief, keeping investors and traders abreast of the latest market critical developments and outlook. And he publishes technical and live updates on his private Twitter feed, which I follow like a hawk. Sven, welcome to the program.
Hi, Chris. Glad to be with you.
Sven, tell us about your market experience, how you prefer to approach analysis and making trading decisions, things like that.
Well, we look at a number of, first of all, let me say we're basically technical analysts. Me and my wife, she's just a premier swing chartist. And obviously, I focus on charts a lot as well, and we use a lot of different indicators, but we like to also keep it simple at the same time. We're not day traders. We're focused more on, like, larger moves to the extent we can, and we try to position for turns, and be it long or on the short side. That's basically our main task, and at the same time, obviously, we're very cognizant of outside influences on markets, market developments, be it news, be it central banks, be it the economy, what have you. And so we keep a close tap on that, and that's what you'll find me write about a lot on Twitter, on my website.
So you heard it in my intro, Sven. I'm basically a card-carrying manipulation theorist. I ascribe a lot of what I've seen in these markets over the past 10 years, really now, to interventions at times rather than legitimate investment decisions, especially at key technical levels, and double especially in the thin overnight futures sessions when things are pretty easy to whip around. Those are my views. What are your views on market structure and how things operate these days?
Well, first of all, there's the aspect of liquidity, right? Mm-hmm. We actually, over the last few years, have seen liquidity dry up quite a bit. And to your point, that allows low volume environments to be conducive to this permanent drift up that we've seen. The lower the volume, the more steady the drift. It's last summer was a good example, right? I mean, the volatility completely died. 2017 was the same way. Very difficult trading environments because you basically are staring at a tape that doesn't move intraday. We've even seen some of that this year so far. You just see these 2-3 handle intraday ranges. And a lot of the action comes via gap ups, magical gap ups, I call them. In fact, earlier this year, we've had this I've been making fun of this on Twitter. You know, if you can find an edge that way, that's great too, right? But we had every Friday, we had basically a risk-free Friday, right? They either came via gap ups, or even if there was a gap down, they magically closed every Friday up, which is quite amazing to see, because, you know, that's not typically how you would view a market environment where a particular day of the week always turns out the same way, right? There's little back and forth. Now, understanding the mechanics behind that is critical to understand, because obviously we need to understand what drives these markets. You know, mm-hmm. We can change what drives these markets, but we need to understand what drives these markets. And so you need to understand who's active, what they're doing, what the influences are. And of course, you know, we had the influences of news items, you know, be it president tweets or Fed speakers or what have you. And you can see what the machines are reacting to, because a lot of the stuff is not fundamental based at all. It's basically just a news flow, and the machines are programmed a certain way. They go a certain way. What we want to understand, obviously, what are the pivot points, what are the points of resistance, and what are the specific indicators that tell us, okay, now we can expect a turn either way, right? That's what we're looking for. And so you know, as much as the environment may frustrate you, or me, or anyone else, you know, that has to be our task, to kind of draw value from these markets. So you got to find where the algos live, and you got to figure out exactly, you know, what they pivot off. So at the end of the day, they're just programmed as well, right? So it's a constant back and forth, understanding the technicals, the macro structure, and what influences. And, you know where you're wrong as well, obviously, with stops.
Absolutely. So a couple of good ideas in there. Let me start with this one. Let's talk a little bit more about this idea that there really aren't investors anymore, in the sense that the markets are so dominated by computer algorithms that those really are now the markets. They're programmed. And you know, we're seeing some obvious weird effects from that. And it's just good to know about this. So I've been trying to educate my audience on the market structure. So take us back. You remember Apple had some slightly disappointing earnings just a little while ago. And later on, almost, you know, within minutes, we saw the New Zealand currency plummet as a response to something that happened to Apple. And my explanation for that is, these are global markets. There are these algorithms. They're running all sorts of complicated pair trades. They have their reasons. They have their rationale. But to somebody who cut their teeth on the markets 20 years ago, I would never have predicted that Apple's earnings disappointment would have led to a crash of the New Zealand dollar relative to the Japanese yen. Is that sort of a reasonable way to sort of put a spotlight on the idea of how intertwined these markets and how computer driven they are?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not like that price is necessarily determined by, you know, millions of individual traders sitting in front of a computer and pressing buy and sell orders. No, not at all. Passive investing obviously is becoming ever larger portion of the investing universe. You have mm-hmm. more ETFs than you actually have stock tickers to invest. And so there's this element of automatic allocations, right? And a lot of these are driven by market cap weightings, for example. So to the extent we have a lot of inflows coming in from passive funds or ETFs, they will buy a certain set of stocks more actively than others, right? Because it's just the way it's allocated. We saw that last summer, for example. And this is one of the things you also want to pay attention to when you see divergences and deviations. In September last year, I'd written this piece called Lying Highs, and I kept pointing out that we saw an ever narrowing slope of this rally in favor of fewer and fewer stocks. It's kind of one of those classic topping signs, but the problem with that is it doesn't give you a precise timing, right? The stuff can drag on and on and on. We saw that throughout last summer. So when these slows come in and they keep buying high cap tech stocks, then all of a sudden you have all, you know, but remember, this went back to Apple $1 trillion, Amazon $1 trillion, and, you know, analysts kept raising the price targets. And so, you know, money keeps flowing in, stock prices go higher, it attracts more money and attracts more money. It becomes kind of this pyramid scheme until something breaks. And that's obviously what we saw in the fall. And it was just too thin prior to that, and it required a technical reaction. And that's the danger of it. So just because, I like to say, just because they're buying doesn't necessarily mean that they know what they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Because these momentum moves, and that's basically what you have, they just defy reason, right? You got to be able to shut off your brain and understand what's driving this. It's not fundamentals necessarily. It's basically just a flow of money at the end of the day and programs buying it. So be aware of the structure of the market.
So let's talk about something you just brought up a few points ago, which was about Risk-Free Friday. That came to a crashing end last week. Here we are again. As a reminder, this is March 26. It's Tuesday. Just a few days ago, we saw a pretty big tumble on Friday, but nothing but bright green roses ever since. How do you make sense of that? How does that fit with your what you've been seeing? Is that a change?
Well, not really at all. I look, I've been very critical of how this rally has performed so far this year. From the December lows, it made perfect sense. We had massive disconnects and deviations and oversold readings. We had some of the most oversold readings since 2009, actually. It was quite impressive. Mm-hmm. And that's why I kept pushing, and there's going to be a very sizable rally. It reminded me a lot of the 2000-2001 transition, because we had a high, we had a wide price range, multiple corrections, and then we had... That was really fascinating, because we had, for the first time since 2000, we had a new yearly low in December. Remember, in September, October, everybody was going on about how, you know, Q4 is guaranteed to be a winner, right? And it's extremely rare to see a new yearly low in December, but that's what happened in December. But technically, it demanded a reconnect. If that was the case I was making, we should see moves to the 50, 200 MA and all that, and just kind of rebalance everything. That made sense to me. But what started them really disconnecting was obviously this incredible flip-flop by the Fed and the timing of such, and how it was driven ever since. And well, we can talk about this a little bit more about the Fed. But basically what we saw then is this entire rally take on a life of its own. And in certain indices, because even though on Friday things were disconnected, they had disconnected prior to Friday, specifically the small caps, transports, and the banks even, right? I mean, obviously the banks got hit on Friday because of the yield curve inversion, but they were already signaling weakness ahead of time. And the trigger for me on Friday was simply the fact that the Fed caved completely. This prior to Friday, it was always kind of a word game. Yes, we're going to be flexible on the balance sheet, and yes, maybe we'll hold off and be patient on rate hikes. But on Friday, they cemented it. They pulled away the carrot. Basically, you know, like with China trade deal, you always have a carrot in front of you. Mm-hmm. But once they made it very clear that they're not going to roll off the, that they're going to end the roll off of the balance sheet in September, and they're going to fully stop on rate hikes in 2019, maybe have one in 2020. That was the Fed's going fully dovish. And then at that point, once the carrot is removed, it's priced in. And I think And obviously, then with the collapse in yields that occurred at the same time in the inversion of the yield curve, that caused that initial plunge. And it was a sizable plunge, right? I mean, we had small caps go down like 3.5%. And what you got to realize is that, you know, you will get short-term oversold readings. And these oversold readings, they will invite bounces. You know, not just because an event happens, the market structure doesn't change. The algorithm is still programmed to buy. And you know, as soon as you get some relief on yields like you did today, then it made sense to see another counter rally to that. Tops are processes, right? And they will frustrate to the max, and they will wear people out. And the psychology is probably the most vast important aspect of trading.
But yeah, I think with the computers and their famous psychology, they don't care, right? They're programmed for certain things. So if they see oversold or whatever strategy they're pursuing, they will follow that. In many cases, I think they're just liquidity gauges, right? If there's money there, they'll chase it.
Well, I'll tell you what, one of the lessons I drew out of 2018 was, and it's so far would be totally validated in 2019. It's a simple lesson, but it's a really challenging one. It's that simply that the extremes will become more extreme. And that's the biggest danger for traders, right? Because you get chopped up. And you know, when things get so extreme, you just want to, you know, what's going on here, right? And you got to be very careful and not losing sight of the big picture, and be patient and wait for the right setup. But yeah, the Fed capitulating on Friday was something else, and I'll tell you why. Because having watched central banks for long, and I've been a critic of central banks for a long time, simply because I do have some macro concerns of what they've done, not only to the market structure, but in terms of how the entire economy is playing out as a result of them. I mean, maybe just go back here in time a little bit. If we go back to 2008, 2009, the premise of the entire intervention game was for it to be temporary, right? QE1, bailout of the banks, all that good stuff. And that made sense, right? The global economy was literally hours away from a major collapse. And I fully understand that they had to go in and rescue the hell out of it. Totally made sense. But then, of course, what we've seen over the last 10 years is that one intervention led to another and another and another. And the promise of this being temporary, obviously, is long gone. And the question that people like myself and asking, how are you going to ever get yourself out of that? And the promise was always, well, we're going to normalize. We're going to reduce the balance sheet. We're going to raise rates because all this fantastic economic growth is going to take place. Well, it hasn't. The fact that we're here now, 10 years after the fact, the Fed tried for 3 months in 2018 to be non-accommodative, right? Jay Powell dropped the accommodative just literally in the September-October timeframe, and it blew up in their faces. And the ECB is still sitting with negative rates. They ended QE at the end of December. And European growth is maybe 1%. I mean, Germany looks around 0.6%. We've never been in an environment where we are entering or risking entering a recession with negative rates. We have no idea what that means. And so the concern is that, you know, this wave of cheap money that is, and this is kind of the story from 2007, except on steroids now, right? Because global debt has increased by $70 trillion. Mm-hmm. We got corporate debt at $6 trillion. And at the same time, when you look at real GDP growth, it's just never kicked into high gear. If you go back to the last 30 years, and you can look at the Fed funds rate, you can look at TNX, 10-year, and you can look at real GDP growth, it's a story of lower highs all around. And it's all sustained by massive, massive debt. And so now that we've tried it for 10 years, and the Fed on Friday admitting that they're done and that they can't do anymore, is highly concerning. Because how do you sustain an economy that can't even handle, you know, 2.5% Fed funds rate?
I totally agree, Sven. I've been a huge critic, going all the way back to Greenspan, and it's frustrating to still be the critic this far down the road, because I thought we had chances to learn along the way. And my primary criticism is this. I think the Fed has made just a colossal blunder by mistaking their interventions in order to prop up a credit cycle as a means of replacing the business cycle. It was hubris, it was conceit, but also the data doesn't support it. What you get with a credit cycle, of course, is lots and lots of credit. It creates the appearance of activity, but not the reality of real economic growth and activity. So it's just as fake as can be, in the sense. And, you know, the way I explain this to people over dinner who don't study economics, I say, listen, imagine if both of you have $100,000 of income and you each have a GDP, therefore, of $100,000, and you go out and work harder and you earn 10% more. Yours is growing an exciting but, you know, modest 10%. This other person borrows $100,000 and spends it on a vacation in a boat. The way we measure things, that's the more exciting economy. It grew by 100%, right? Credit is only good if it's being applied to useful things, and much of the credit in a credit cycle gets put into dumb things. That's just the nature of it. I don't understand how they fail to understand this at the Fed, but boy, I think credit bubbles are terrible, and they create a really bad hangover when they finally let go.
you know, as much as a Fed critic as I am, I also sympathize with them on one level. And the fact is they're dealing with two major issues, or the economy is dealing with two major issues. One is obviously demographics. There's a demographic wave that is just not changeable, and it's got implications. Obviously, we have unfunded liabilities. We've got a whole replacement cycle going on that is not conducive to productivity. And then on top of that, we have the greatest deflationary force the planet has ever seen, technology, right? It's the fact that you have the biggest companies on the planet, really, in terms of market cap, being able to effectively manage millions and millions and millions, in some cases, billions of customers, like Facebook, right? Facebook does not need that many people to handle millions and millions of customers. So there's this deflationary force that's built into the economy, and that's preventing from proper growth taking place as well. At the same time, you've got all these debt issues that are not being resolved. So it's like a natural break that's on the economy, and they can't solve it. And maybe take this to a bigger part. We have no political structure anywhere globally at the moment, it seems, that is able to address structural issues in any shape or form. And central banks are basically there to keep the boogeyman at bay. Right? I mean, I don't see it in the U.S. I don't see it in Europe. I mean, take Brexit as an example. I mean, it's total chaos. There's no way to come to a cohesive solution on anything. And how do you fix the structural issues in economies if you don't have any type of political cohesion taking place? And there's really no way out of that.
No, there isn't. And, you know, Ben Hunt of Salient Partners wrote a great piece recently where he compared Jerome Powell to Arthur Burns, the former Fed chairman back under Nixon, who completely caved to political pressures back then. It looks to me that that's not an unfair comparison. I think Jerome Powell has not just caved to the markets. I think he caved to political winds, gave Trump everything Trump could ever have wanted for really not good reasons, as far as I'm concerned. You said that Powell, the Fed, has caved. That's perhaps not too strong a word, but worse, perhaps, in this line of thinking. Trump just nominated Stephen Moore to the Federal Reserve Board. For people listening, I'll give you a link so you can get a sense of who Stephen Moore is. But in your own estimation, Sven, who is Stephen Moore, and what does he bring in terms of outlook, qualifications, all that? And what is it? Is Jerome Powell the Arthur Burns of our times?
Well, I mean, Stephen Moore, I've seen a few interviews with him. I have not gathered a sense of any proper understanding of economics or markets. I mean, I can only refer to him as maybe a potential political hack. I mean, he's not, his positions change as administration changes. The problem with the Fed here right now is that basically the appearance is awful in terms of what happened. December 18th, Trump came out with a tweet about stop the 50 Bs, right? Basically demanding that the Fed stop the balance sheet roll-off. And just literally a few weeks later, Jay Powell came out on January 4th and said he's flexible with the balance sheet. And not only that, now in March he stopped it. So the timeline is very unfavorable. Just the appearance. See, the Fed was supposed to be independent, right?
Yeah.
But the Fed over the years has obviously become increasingly susceptible to market fluctuations. It used to be that the Fed would do what the Fed would do, even if it was uncomfortable to markets. But those days are long gone, right? And I think the bigger problem here is simply that there's a big reality here. Markets and economies are totally intertwined now. And if you have a massive sell-off that lasts longer than a few days, you're going to see economic impact that's negative. And maybe that's the big unspoken truth. And that's partially explains why we see certain Fed activity at certain times. Yeah, obviously they want to prevent a recession to the extent that they can.
And why is it that markets are now so intertwined? That didn't used to be the case. They were the indicator of economic health, but you're saying now they're enmeshed with economic health. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, for one thing, it ties everything together, financial services, lending, confidence. give you a perfect example. Why do you think December retail sales were terrible?
Because the market fell. Yeah.
Why was confidence up in January? Because the markets rallied hard. I mean, there's a like-for-like link there, right? And it's all overall consumer psychology, right? So if you have bad headlines, you've got plunging markets, obviously then people have 401ks or they have investments, and that curbs spending very clearly.
All right. So if we look at to turn now to tie this in and say, okay, so we've got these markets, a lot of computers driving them. They're also enmeshed because we have a very financialized economy at this point in time. Absolutely the case. So let's look at where we really are in the economy for now. Okay, so Sven, it looks to me like a recession's not only coming, but maybe here. I'm looking at the slump in the Baltic Dry Index. We've got the Chinese PMI data. We've got German industrial production. You mentioned the German economy at stall speed, but their Indpro looks really low. U.S. housing data, all these, many more indicators seem to be flashing red lights. What are your thoughts here in terms of a recession watch?
Well, I'm always aware of the triggers for the upside. Be aware that obviously the slowdown here in Q1, take the December correction out of the picture for a moment. It's not unusual to see a kind of a slowing slope in Q1. We've had a number of years before, and then we had a pickup again. Having said all that, the reality is that the extent of the slowdown is much deeper than anyone had anticipated at this point. I call it this morning chasing reality, right? Because all the projections that were made in 2018 about how 2019 would turn out to be completely wrong. And maybe there's a new, the way I'm seeing this right now is that even the inversion of the yield curve is now being dismissed. It's kind of, it's just temporary. It's just a fluke. And I'm wondering if people are going to be chasing reality furthermore into this year, because if things were related to the government shutdown or if they were related to the December correction, then why are PMI still dropping? Why are manufacturing numbers still dropping in March? Maybe we can explain some of this with global trade, but the reality is we are really long in the tooth here on the business cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a lot of hope right now that if there's a trade deal with China and maybe there's a miraculous Brexit recovery, that all this turns around and recession fears go away. It's possible, but there's obviously the other possibility that the macro wheels have already turned so deep that it's going to take, maybe it's not even possible. I mean, the machine is already on its way. Earlier I mentioned the 2000-2001 example. And the reason I like that one, not only because of the structure of the highs and then the December lows, is because the Fed stopped its rate hike cycle at that time. And 6 months later, we were in a recession. It was much faster than anyone had anticipated. Remember, 2000 was also related to the tech bubble, as you may well remember.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what 2018 was all about, right? Tech can do no wrong. And we've had these massive valuations. We had these massive disconnects. And then we had a big fat correction. So there's structurally some similarities here. And I hate to say, well, you can compare one period to another. You really can't. I'm just noticing some overall similarities. It may well be that a China deal will bring a lot of optimism back. But we haven't seen a China deal yet. We haven't seen any specifics of it yet. So it's all basically psychology at this point and not a lot of substance to go on.
Well, the good news is the potential of a China trade deal has been, I don't know, maybe used 20 times to rally the markets. The president's tweets are famous for that. Help me understand, help our listeners understand this. How much of a drag on the markets is a lack of a deal with China actually? I mean, in terms of numbers, do we have a sense of just how much things are really truly being held back, or is it really just a question of psychology more than actual substance here?
I don't see the market being held back by China other than on the yield front. I mean, equities haven't been held back. I mean, the stocks actually made an all-new all-time high last week. Can you imagine?
Yeah. Well, it seems like the market rallies hard every time, Trump says, progress made looks good. Thumbs up, right?
So, well, it's the anticipation of a deal. I think a lot of it is already priced in. It's the concern is, are you going to get the classic Tilden news event? We may well get a big pop on a China announcement. It's very, very possible. I have no insight as to when we're going to get something. I'm frankly kind of maybe on the sidetrack here, but I'm not sure if I were the Chinese, why would they accept a deal that's not in their interest?
Yeah.
So, they have different election cycles than we do, right? And we have another U.S. election next year. Maybe it's in their favor to wait this thing out. I have no idea. It's completely speculative. But I'm surprised we haven't gotten a deal yet.
Well, yeah, so this raises the other idea is that if we look back at the sweep of things where really who is providing the stimulus and where it came from, I credit China with doing a lot of the heavy lifting of getting us out of that. Things were really falling apart late 2015, early 2016. We had all the emerging market troubles. We had the dollar spiking. We had bear markets breaking out everywhere. And then things magically turned around somewhere in early February of 2016. Looking back at the data, we see, okay, the ECB was dumping a ton of money into the markets, but so is China. Really good piece of work that I follow closely out of Saxo Bank is their credit impulse model. Looking at China, it looks like their credit-driven economy has kind of run out of steam. Are you tracking that at all?
I have not. Obviously, I'm aware of the stimulus measures they've undertaken starting in January. Just maybe to your point about 2016. We had an earnings recession there, and actually the global economy was close to getting into a recession in 2016. And you know what happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was $5.5 trillion of global central bank intervention that followed, and it was Janet Yellen obviously that halted the rate hike schedule in February, and that was after the banks had dropped like 23% following the initial rate hike. So I think there's a lot of scripting thought here that says maybe that's what we're repeating here vis-a-vis 2016, right? We have an earnings recession now, central banks are turning dovish, but back then it took $5.5 trillion to really boost markets up. And I don't see that type of intervention at this point at all.
And is that because it's politically not possible, or the central banks are just not geared for that? I mean, they clearly will do whatever it takes in Draghi's terms. I'm curious, because I think that's really where I'm leading with all this. It feels a little bit like the market is anticipating that how it got rescued in 2016 will do that again. I don't think that can happen for a variety of reasons, but I'd be interested to hear yours.
No, I mean, the ECB cannot do QE right now. That's done. Yeah, they've talked about the LTRO, bringing that maybe back in the summer, but that's not a really major thing. So I think the ECB is kind of trapped at this point. And here's the other thing, and this is I keep emphasizing this as well. Central bankers will never give people advance notice that a recession is coming. They are in the confidence game because of exactly what I mentioned before, interlinked between economy and markets and confidence. You got to keep confidence up. If Jay Powell went out and said, there's going to be a recession, we think there's going to be a recession by December, that would have consequences, right? That would freak people out. That would cause selling. You can't do that. So to that extent, central banking is always a political game. And Draghi right now and the ECB is in the same position. They are now proclaiming, while we didn't see the slowdown coming, yes, growth maybe only 0.5%, but don't worry, there won't be a recession. Come on, you can't be serious, right? You can't. If you didn't see that amount of slowdown coming, you can't predict that there won't be a recession, especially if you're skirting your projections this close to recession territory. So it's an interesting time. I think the entire market construct is now dependent on the China deal coming through and maybe some sort of magic Brexit miracle. Because without those two triggers, I don't know what the carrot is right now. Because the Fed's just taking itself out of the game.
Yeah, so let's talk about one of the upsides of the bullish case, of course, which has been the earnings per share growth, say, in the S&P 500. I interviewed Lance Roberts a few weeks back, and he pointed out, and we posted this chart, that while earnings per share, yes, it's spiked a lot over the past 5 years, earnings themselves have not. Those are kind of dead flat over 5 years. But the earnings per share is up, principally because corporations, of course, loaded up on about $5 trillion of new debt, bought back about $5 trillion of their shares. That spiked earnings per share because there are fewer shares outstanding to put the same amount of earnings against. So, in other words, the bull case rests largely on this earnings explosion carrying on, but it seems unsustainable to me because it rests on two things, right? One, no recessions. Two, corporations have to borrow more and more and buy back more shares to retire in the future. What do you make of that overall dynamic of corporate earnings per share and how it's been driven?
Well, 2018, obviously EPS on a year-to-year comparison basis jumped dramatically, primarily tax cut-driven. Right? And to your point, we've had all these buybacks, and these buybacks obviously reduced the float. And so you can actually have the same amount of earnings year after year, but to the extent that you reduce your float, it looks like you have earnings growth. Right? Mm-hmm. But that's a favorite game that's been played. And obviously right now in 2019, we're on another record pace of buybacks, still courtesy of the tax cuts from last year. But to the data that you mentioned by Lance, I actually put out a chart a couple of days ago that looked at corporate income over the last 10 years, 15 years, and compared it to corporate debt. And speaking off the top of my head, it was Q3 2014 actually had slightly higher income on a corporate basis, but corporate debt since that time frame, just the last few years, has increased by a full $1 trillion. And if you go back even further to 2006, Q3 2006 to now, corporate income has only increased by 17%. Yet corporate debt has doubled since then, and that's the inefficiency of what it takes to basically to keep the system moving, and that's the big concern, obviously.
Yeah, and so how does take us through that story? So corporations have obviously loaded up on a lot of debt. Listen, if I'm in the C-suite, I understand the motivation, right? We're all getting compensated based on how earnings per share grows, and I can borrow at 1% and retire shares that are yielding 3% to make up a story. I can make a case for that. But beyond that, when I look at the overall loading up of debt, a lot of it BBB in nature on the corporate side, and looking at all these buybacks, it feels like there, when a recession comes and there's some sort of a reckoning, take us through that process. It feels like the corporations are fairly exposed here. That's how I see it. Bulls say, wait, they've got a lot of cash on the balance sheet. I say, well, they also have a lot of debt on the balance sheet. If you got a sense of where we are in this story, are corporations in better shape or worse shape than they might have been, say, in 2007?
Well, it's all a matter of debt sustainability, and as long as you have a very low rate environment, they can actually sustain it. I mean, that's the argument that continues to be made. And that's why rates actually stopped. If you look at the yields, they had to stop where they did stop in the fall. Actually, just taking a side note here on the technical, the TNX, I have a chart on that, it's fascinating. There's a trend line going back to the early 1980s, every time we tagged that trend line, yields reverse. And that's exactly what happened in September, October, tagged the trend line, reversed. So technically, actually, what we're seeing makes perfect sense. But now go back to the debt question. If you are entering a recession, your cash position is going to change rather rapidly, right? Because you still have your operating expenses, and you're going to have to find a way to create efficiency. Part of the story on buybacks is obviously also corporations don't have really any good investment opportunities. And Warren Buffett talked about that he doesn't know what to buy because he doesn't see any good values out there. So may as well turn it into buybacks. It's a rather inefficient system, but it works for now.
Sure, it works as long as things keep going. So really, honestly, this seems a lot to hinge on where the central banks are, what they're going to do. They capitulated. It turned out that the world couldn't even handle a slight reduction in the Fed's balance sheet, even though it's a global economy. And we look at global central bank liquidity across, say, the big seven central banks. Even though the Fed was reducing its balance sheet, that was the story. Oh, my gosh, look, they're unwinding their balance sheet. Looks impressive. Many hundreds of billions rolled off. But overall, when you look at Japan, ECB, China included as well, nothing changed. There was still plenty of liquidity. But since December, according to the way I track these things, over $500 billion was chucked into the markets or into the system as in response to that December bit. This looks like it's all a central bank game. So do you think, Sven, that the ECB is kind of out of ammo here, can't do much politically? The Fed seems at best they're going to hold pat. Who knows what Japan's up to? That they seem to be a little more activist than who knows where they're going. China, also a little bit of a probably a mystery here. How do we read all of this at this point in time going forward? What would you say is the summary of where the central banks are now?
I think central banks are back to fully dovish. There won't be no rate hikes in the foreseeable future. Markets are pricing in a rate cut. And I think actually in this time around, a rate cut would be bearish for markets because, as I mentioned that TNX line earlier, once that flip occurs, typically markets follow. Now, they haven't so far, and this is kind of an interesting technical spot where we're at. If you're of the view that this has been a bear market rally, then you know things could certainly lead to a retest or new lows. We haven't seen the evidence for that yet. That's why kind of Friday was interesting. I've been tracking a chart for a few months that showed that actually on the logarithmic basis, the 2009 trend broke in December. There was a very steady trend line that actually connected with the 2016 lows, and that trend line was tested a few times in the fall and then finally broken in December. And what markets have done so far is move right back up to that trend line. Now, what I would have liked to have seen from a technical perspective is a clear, clean rejection of that trend line. But what has happened instead with this constant job owning is we keep tagging that trend line on a daily basis and on a weekly basis. The trend line is rising, so it becomes more and more difficult for markets to catch it. But what one would want to see from a bearish perspective is see a clear rejection of that trend line. Hasn't happened yet, and that's why markets frustrated, right? So we got to see how this plays out.
Great.
But from that perspective, structurally, it is still possible this is going to be a market rally.
And what are the key levels that you're looking at here, say for the S&P or NASDAQ or any numbers you have at hand?
Well, first of all, recognize that last week we actually got very close to the January 2018 highs. If markets can move above there, I think you have to window open to do a retest of the old highs. So, for example, a China deal or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We saw just now a little dip below 2,800 that was saved, obviously, overnight. There is a lot of confluence support. If you look at the 2737, 2752 area, by confluence, I mean there are a number of technical factors aligned. This may be too deep here for the discussion, but I'll just give you the five that I see. There's already the 50 MA, the 200 MA, there's the lower Bollinger Band. We've got a Fibonacci level led at 23.66 from that rally, and there's an open gap. So you have five areas. To me, that says if we were to move down there, there's very strong support there initially. Okay, bears, unless they can drop this market, sustain below the 50 MA, have nothing. I hate to say it. We're in a chop range. We're in the wider price range of 2018. And until sellers can drop it below there, it's going to be tough slugging for them.
Well, all right. So let's last question here is about the budget deficits in the U.S. Pretty massive. I can't believe that we have numbers that I'm seeing now. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I wouldn't have believed it. But here we are. Nobody seems too concerned about those in the financial media. I think you have a different view. Well, what's your thoughts on the U.S. budget deficits here? Anything we need to be concerned with, or is there just so much liquidity in the world? Who cares?
Well, by the way, keep in mind, every time you see a big budget deficit number, that means there is artificial overstatement of GDP numbers, right? Yep. Because deficit numbers, by definition, are counted as part of GDP. So $234 billion monthly deficit in February, part of your GDP number. So that in itself shows you maybe how overstated Q1 may be. So actually, Q1 may be coming a little bit better than was initially estimated, because we have all this debt filtering, and it's all part of the equation. Look, the reality is that we are heading toward an environment where the interest on debt is going to be exceeding the national defense budget of the United States, which, as you know, is just a massive program on its own. And with unfunded liability and ever more debt and ever more interest payments, you're going to get into a situation where you cannot fund your discretionary budget. The U.S. has a discretionary budget and a non-discretionary budget. The non-discretionary is all the Medicare, Social Security, and all that stuff. A lot of that cannot be touched. And so it will curb a government's ability to function, because it has to make cuts across the board. And that's, I think, what we're seeing from the administration in terms of proposals. You know, they put in the big tax cuts last year. Now they have massive deficits blowing up in their face, and they have to make cuts, because the fundamental truth is tax cuts didn't pay for themselves, and deficits were not shrinking as a result of 3-4% growth. And here's maybe my biggest concern in all of this. It's not only the administration, but it's also the Congressional Budget Office. Everybody is working with financial projections that are assuming 3% GDP growth forever. I've not seen anyone come out with a recession scenario, just even as a stress test. I mean, you know, I used to be in corporate finance, and, you know, if you have any sort of forecast, business forecast, you always stress test it against variables. If we have $1 trillion deficits now before a recession, what is this going to look like in a recession? So I think, you know, to your point, no political party seems to really care about it. It doesn't seem to be in the agenda. I remember they used to be also fiscal conservatives. I don't know what happened to them. There's no one in the political leadership, be it in Congress or the Fed or anyone, that's really speaking out against it. I heard Janet Yellen once say that she was keeping her awake at night about the debt to GDP ratio, but nothing's been done about it, obviously.
Oh, that was clearly after she left office. So. Right.
It was.
Nobody has those concerns when they're in office.
No, of course not. No. And by the way, what she did say in 2016, and I think everybody should pay attention to those statements as well, because we heard some of that Fed speak on Monday this week. What are they going to do if there's a recession? And Janet Yellen did propose at the time that it would be helpful for the Fed to be able to buy stocks directly.
I know.
So it's coming.
It's unfair that the Swiss National Bank in Japan are having all that fun without us, you know. And one of the pieces I point out, which there's a lot of smoke here, no fire yet. But, you know, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the CME, actually has a central bank preferred buyers program. It's right on their website. They say, listen, you guys are such heavy buyers of our products that we're going to give you our preferred buyer program. So they have the best volume discounts. That means central banks are buying stuff on the CME. What's traded there? Well, you know, futures and options on things like, you know, it could be bonds, but there's also equities and commodities and other things. So here's the fun part. I know that the buying program exists. I've scoured every central bank website in the world, and none of them will admit to having any CME products on their books. And I'm just curious. I would love to know what they're buying and when. And I think that would be pretty interesting information to have at some point. Love to know.
But, you know, the most amazing central bank on the planet is the SMB in Switzerland, right? I mean, they print their own money, and they buy Apple and Google. Buy a Fang board. I mean, it's amazing. You know, print your money and buy stocks.
It's good work if you can get it. I've been trying to do that for years, but this Secret Service doesn't seem to like it when I do that, so I don't know.
But don't worry. There are no market distortions whatsoever.
No, don't worry. Don't worry about any of that stuff. Well, hey, and we are out of time here, too, and we've been talking with Sven Henrich. He's the founder, lead market strategist at Northman Trader. You can find excellent commentary at northmantrader.com, also on Twitter, at Northman Trader, all one word, at Northman Trader is the handle there. Sven, any other way people can or should follow you?
Now, Twitter is really the most prominent place. That's where I hang out most of the time. I've got the most interaction, but obviously on the website, and you can also follow the public email link that's on the website. But Twitter is usually a good place to find me.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your interview time today and for all the work you put out on Twitter, because that's a great way to follow you there. So thank you for both accounts.
Thanks, Chris. I very much enjoyed the time with you.
Likewise.